Good day, listeners of KGBM 95.9 Bozeman, and welcome to The View From Here. I'm Steve Kirchhoff, along with Jeff Milchin, my partner in our enterprise of talk freedom. I welcome Dr. Sarah Rushing, a professor of political science at Montana State University, to the KGBM studio. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
We're here today for a multifaceted conversation about Black Lives Matter, citizen activism, neoliberalism, democracy, and the future of America in these authoritarian times, and whatever else might occur to us, and about whatever else seems relevant to our social and cultural survival, even. An avid ukulele player with a wonderful lilting voice and a passion for making music, Sarah is also a mother of three, a positive force for equity on MSU campus, a philosopher deeply engaged with ethics and activism, a teacher, a writer, and a citizen of Bozeman, Montana. Sarah is trained in political and feminist theory, and her research works at the intersection of politics and ethics. She's interested in questions of freedom and the production of radical political subjectivity. Recently, she completed a book titled The Virtues of Vulnerability, Humility, Autonomy, and Citizen Subjectivity. So welcome again, Sarah, to The View From Here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. I'm interested to know what you're thinking, basically, and I would like to make the questions as broad and as open as possible to start with, because I think that you have some valuable perspectives to share, and I'm really fascinated to know, as you have been witnessing the massive protests against police brutality, particularly brutality against blacks in the black communities in America, these protests that have been occurring for the last 2 weeks after the murder of George Floyd. How do you see these events, just in the most basic of senses, as a citizen, as a person, as a mother, however you want to parse the question? For you, what's the significance of what you're witnessing in terms of the protest movement?
I think it's really hard to know the significance in the moment. I think when I have observed and participated in the last couple of weeks and the last couple of months and the last couple of years in racial justice activism in Bozeman, following the lead of some really great people of color in town who have been pioneers when there wasn't a lot of energy behind them. I found that I have kind of both a cynic and an optimist in me. And the optimist in me really embraces the narrative that, like, we're turning over a new leaf and now white people are seeing what's really going on, and they're motivated and they're committed to act. And the cynic in me is not ever so sure that's the case. And in any given moment, those two are doing battle inside me. And I think that's a productive battle. I don't think we ever want to give in to either the cynic or the optimist, because I think it's the tension between the two that drives us forward and helps us persevere. If we were totally optimistic, I think we'd give up pretty soon. And if we were totally cynical, I'm not sure we'd ever engage. And so in this moment, those two parts of me are in a productive tension, but I don't know which one of them will prevail. And I hope it's the optimist. I think if Bozeman is any indication right now, we are seeing a different kind of engagement, a different kind of realization on the part of white people who want to combat racism, and a shift, I think, nationally in the last couple of years between thinking, if you're not part of the problem, your hands are clean, versus, you know, being an active anti-racist. So I think the discourse has changed in a really important way. And, you know, we'll see what that means for long-term committed action on the part of white people, who are the people in the best position to change racism.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when you situate this protest movement, if you want to call it Black Lives Matter Revisited, I don't know what to call it exactly. It seems like another wave, perhaps, of Black Lives Matter. Do you situate this within, like, larger historical trends? Like, do you liken it to, say, the civil rights movement of the 1960s, or do you think it's more akin to something like the riots that occurred after the Rodney King debacle? Do you see it as part of a movement, as a part of a restructuring, that, like, the kind of thing that civil rights was doing versus Jim Crow laws? Or do you see this more as a reaction to specific things?
I think it's definitely reaction, but I think it's reaction that isn't just to an event. And in that sense, it's probably less like the Rodney King moment and more like the civil rights of the 60s. But I also think we are just in such a unique historical time compared to the 60s. And I also think the left in particular, when it is backward looking, right? I mean, like traditionally progressives are forward looking and conservatives are backwards looking, but when the left is backwards looking, it tends to be towards these glorious moments of social change. And they're great and they're crucial and they're always outliers. So my hope is that we wouldn't actually try to replicate those movements, but create a movement for this time, which is has to be fundamentally different. It has to be much more attentive to the persistent realities on the ground. It has to be much more savvy about social media use. It has to be much more aware of the broad systemic overlapping problems, not the least of which is like the gutting of higher education, which makes a huge difference in how you educate people about history. People who don't know anything about history are very hard to organize for long-term systemic progressive change. So I think that there are hints of all of those past movements, but that this is going to be a distinct moment. And the real question will be whether the commitment to action that people are being asked to take sticks, right? Whether people can break it down to not trying to replicate these kind of glorious cultural moments like, you know, activism of the 60s, and instead can say, you know, this has to be much more sort of systematic commitment on the part of whites to not just show up with signs, but to donate money, to make phone calls, to do all these things in a way that is going to have to exceed the moments of passion.
Well put. So I'm curious, when you say that the understanding of history is essential for successful social movements, what are some of the key lessons that you think people learn from understanding the history of social movements that really need to be effectively conveyed?
I mean, I think there are a lot of things that people need to learn. And I will say that I'm not a historian. I'm a political theorist. And a number of political theorists today are very frustrated with how bad political theory is at history. So how ahistorical political theory can be, because it can kind of be more historical or more philosophical. And it tends to be more philosophical, more political. And I will admit to being myself a bad historian. I have not studied history systematically, but I think now that it's crucial in order to sort of have a longer perspective, and maybe now that I'm almost 50, history makes a lot more sense to me than it did when I was 20. But what are some of the lessons? I mean, when I think about this, I sometimes think about it in a context that's more familiar to me, which is feminist social movements. And if you don't understand the history of feminist social movements, you miss that they are very episodic, that they are often followed by long periods of silence, that they hinge a lot on how inclusive the movement is. And when the movement is not very inclusive, it sacrifices energy and momentum for cohesion. I think there are lots of other things looking backwards. I mean, I think some of these lessons I'm still learning, but when I talk about some of this stuff to my students, I mean, Ronald Reagan now is not someone they really know. If I say Rodney King, that doesn't mean anything to them. Even 9/11 is like a distant, you know, that was, they were just babies. So, and if you look, Bob Rydell is a history professor at MSU, and he did kind of a quick survey to see what are MSU students studying in terms of how are they learning civics? How are they learning to be citizens, right? We're a land-grant institution in a state aimed at educating the working sons and daughters of this state, not just for employment, but for citizenship. So how are they learning citizenship? And what Bob found was that only about 15% of students going through MSU take a history class, an American history class, and only about 15% of students going through MSU take American government. So yeah, they think they're getting that in high school, and they certainly are, you know, in maybe more extensive and less extensive forms. But to me, that's really telling.
That's surprising.
Yeah, I know.
And there's certainly a difference between studying when, you know, in large part, the teachers at the high school level have to be focused mm-hmm. on preparing them to pass standardized tests versus being able to have a little more deeper understanding, hopefully, through the discussions that you might have in a classroom at the university.
Right. And I think when you look at history, not just as a set of facts you need to memorize for your test, but as a sort of story of who we are, you have to know how those stories have been told and by whom in order to think about how we might tell different stories going forward. So history, I think, is always also about thinking about the future. And what are our imaginations stocked with? Our imaginations are not very well stocked with an understanding of our past. It's very hard to think creatively about a different future.
Also, when you were talking, Sarah, you said that the feminist movement, which is now, what, half a century old or longer, going back to suffrage? I don't know where you mark the beginning, but well, in any event, let's say...
It's a movement to get to suffrage.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think often people start at, 1844, okay. Seneca Falls Conference, yeah.
So a half a dozen generations of human beings, if not more, right? And you said that the movement itself is characterized by its episodic character, right? Mm-hmm. So there are movements forward. There's a surge, there's a push, some gains are made, and then it subsides. Mm-hmm. Then it's rekindled later, perhaps with slightly different objectives. How important is it to have objectives that are concrete in a movement? Because many white people will say, well, since 2006, it's a fact that fewer black men are incarcerated than were before. And the number of incidents of police brutality, even with body cameras and more surveillance over what police are doing, the number of incidents has actually decreased. So shouldn't we be giving ourselves a tiny pat on the back for making some progress? I don't know how that comment would be taken by someone inside this movement right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to appreciate change. I mean, I always get nervous when someone says, oh, but it's so much better than it used to be, because to me that is typically a conversation stopper. Nonetheless, in many ways, the reality for women, for people of color, for lesbians, gays, right, for religious minorities is better, than it was 100 years ago. I don't know if that's something to be super excited about, but it is better. But...
So my question, the question really was, I guess I took the word episodic to mean backsliding, and that may or may not be how you meant it, but I could see someone who feels very passionate about Black Lives Matter right now slapping me for having given my white back a pat for the progress that has been made in the 13 years since 2006, when I saw the statistics recently, that incarceration has decreased, right? As a percentage of the total black male population, it's fewer men behind bars now, less acts of police brutality. And I think that no one in the Black Lives community is going to give me a mutual pat for that comment, yeah. Right? Because what it's lacking is a longer, a more enduring sense of the inequities, right? And if there has been an episode of improvement, that doesn't mean that what needs to be gained has actually been gained.
Right. You know? I mean, I think so. I think I have two answers to your question. One is that it's really important to be problem-centered in this work. What are the problems to be solved? Right, because I think that, again, if you don't have a history of sort of redlining, of denying loans to people of color, all these things, so those things have changed, not fully, but they've changed. So in a sense, those were problems to be solved, and policy and power and people have addressed those to a point, and that's progress. But I think if you don't have a clear sense of what are the problems to be solved today, then your movement won't have momentum. So I think that's great. I also think once you set kind of benchmarks and metrics, which is the stock and trade of neoliberalism, right, is sort of the instrumentalization of everything. Once you sort of articulate those goals in kind of quantifiable ways, when you reach them, a lot of people think we're done. and I think, where I've seen this most clearly is in work about gender equality on campus, for example, in STEM departments, right? So many departments see creating greater gender equality in STEM, like in engineering, in the sciences, as an ongoing project. They buy into the fact that gender equality isn't just about numbers, it's about culture change, it's about climate, it's about inclusion and advancement. So they buy into that project, and it's going to be a long-term commitment for them. And others say, we need to hire 4 women. We did it. Check. We're good. And for me, that kind of social change is very problematic, because often it sort of re-entrenches the original set of problems. It doesn't address them. So I think it's both important to have concrete goals so you know if you're making progress on solving the problems, and also understand that culture and climate are notoriously slow to change and very quick to backslide.
So it could happen that, let's say, the city of Minneapolis goes forward and decides that they're no longer going to fund their police departments to the extent that they did before. And maybe they'll even retrain their entire force and disarm them and give them pepper spray or a nightstick and that's about the extent of their weaponry. But nevertheless, if it was policy for them to fund to a lesser degree and retrain their police force, that could be a benchmark, right? That could be a sign of having made a success. Is it that kind of thing that you're afraid of, that, oh, we got it in Minneapolis. The movement was not for naught, right? It resulted in something. Is that the kind of thing that a too eager acceptance of a reform to be satisfied?
No, I think that that's important and it's a meaningful start. And then the question is, do you have a citizen oversight committee? And how do you evaluate whether that's a deep cultural change or just a policy change? And who gets to say? And who collects the data? And how is the data disseminated? You know, and so I think those are all the subsequent steps to any change that frequently don't happen, or people get tired, they move on. Citizens don't think of themselves as having to vigilantly see all of that through, because that's part of why we have elected officials who are supposedly doing that work for us. And I think that's often where the failures happen, right? A lot of it is in, are there paid commissions to study these reforms and how they work? I mean, certainly plenty of academics are studying this, and part of what I think is scary politically today is that a lot of elected officials aren't listening to them. And a lot of elected officials are very proudly not listening to them. And that, to me, is really terrifying. So you can make well-meaning changes in a moment of crisis, and that is definitely a step in the right direction. But all of that follow-up, which is just mundane nitty-gritty, is where the real solidification of the change happens.
Just following up on what you mentioned, Sarah, about questioning whether leaders care about what people at the grassroots think. I mean, that's one of the things that's been going through my mind. We had, going back a couple of years, massive marches around the country, women-led marches in I don't know how many different cities, but they were huge. They got very little media coverage, relatively speaking, compared to, say, what a handful of armed protesters demanding we reopen states for business got, and the leaders, political leaders, seem to largely ignore those protests. Of course, now we've seen some pretty dramatic responses in Minneapolis, in San Francisco, in Chicago, and other cities to the protests that have gone on in the past week. And the biggest difference, aside from, you know, having a much younger and more multiracial component, is there were outbreaks of police-incited violence in most cases. There were incidents of widespread vandalism. Whether or not those people had anything to do with the protests or not has certainly not been demonstrated. But is that what it takes to get leaders to care? Because mass public uprising and demonstration of opposition didn't seem to make much of a difference a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the women's marches were fundamentally different in the sense that they were, in many cases, they worked to be bipartisan, which is, you know, can be a really hard sell in terms of having a clear vision of what problems exist to be solved. I think in terms of gender, there are just differences in the kind of problems that exist to be solved today. I mean, domestic violence is still a huge problem, but it doesn't happen in public. The pay gap is not sexy. It's incredibly important. Paid family leave, extended childcare, the things that make a difference to gender equality in the workplace at home, those are, you know, they're not, they're important, but they're not eye-catching. And so I think those are really important movements. What I think would be really meaningful is if the women's movement really, which has now sort of quieted down a bit, for no reason I can put my finger on, but would join forces with Black Lives Matter and say, let us put all our people power behind your movement, because if Black Lives Matter succeeds, it's going to make the world better for all disenfranchised and oppressed people.
Choose me, choose me, choose me. I have a question.
Steve, do you have a question?
I'm sorry, you must be used to that, right?
I'm good.
And if I wave my hand enough, how does somebody else's problem become mine? You know, when you talk about the women's movement, they obviously have their goals, right? They have their reason for taking to the streets. Black Lives Matter has their reasons for taking to the streets. And different people on all groups have their reasons. But how does your plight, your predicament become mine?
Well, I mean, I'm always torn on this question, right? Like, I think there's one way of saying racial injustice is bad for all of us. I think that's true. I benefit immensely from white privilege, and I'm sure there would be an adjustment to not having that privilege. It's almost impossible for me to imagine that world at this point, but I'm totally behind it. But nonetheless, I'm sure it would feel like a real shift, where at times I thought, I didn't even realize the extent of the privilege. So you know, is racism my problem the way it is for people of color in this country? It isn't. I mean, it's my problem to solve. White people are the cause of it, and if we want to undo it, white people are the people who should undo it. But I don't feel it the same way every day.
Mm-hmm.
So part of me is like, it doesn't matter if this is my problem. It's my problem as a citizen. It's my problem as someone who wants to take responsibility. But I don't need to feel it in the same way to act on it. And if that's the standard, then that explains why a lot of white people aren't acting on it. And I also think, do I need to persuade men that patriarchy is bad for them to get them to want to undo it? Like, maybe, but also, like, just undo it, right? Like, just, if you care about democracy and equality, that's part of it. So,
well, I can remember, speaking of civics, I used to teach in my writing courses just because, the language of Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail is beautiful. The sentiments are profound. The morality is deep. And the timing of the letter, of course, is hugely significant. And that's an instance in which he was writing to the white clergy that had continually told him, can you just slow down, please?
Can you
wait for us? Yeah, wait for us, because if you wait long enough, we can get our people to act right and think right, and we can correct the situation, but you need to wait. And he wrote the letter in response to that notion of waiting, and the letter is full of eloquence and beautiful statements and truisms, but he was scolding the well-intentioned white moderate, this person, I'm a member of the white male class of the patriarchy. I would say, to some extent, yeah, I do need to be trained, don't I? I mean, how am I going to take your plight as mine unless I'm sensitized to my privilege, unless I'm, like, I'm not sure if instructed is the right word, but in some sense, sensitized to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a part of education and civics?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think people need a much broader understanding of the history, the nature of these problems, and their kind of intergenerational role in it, and the power of activism, and what makes a difference, and what the, to the extent that white people can understand it, what the lived experience of people of color is every day. Like, I think those things matter, and they stir our passions. They stir our democratic passions and our passions for change, and I think those passions are important, but they're not sustainable. So I think, to the extent that white people are expecting to have a fire lit under them that never goes out the way that black people do because they have to live with every day, that's just not reasonable. And if that's what you're looking for to make you an agent of change, then that's just sort of fated to fail.
Short of that, how does one become an agent of change if one is well-intentioned?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, you listen to the people who have been leading these marches, leading these movements for generations, right? I mean, we don't need to reinvent the wheel right now just because a whole lot of white people just woke up to it. There are people who have been doing this work for decades in our modern moment and are perfectly happy to tell you what the right thing to do is, right? I mean, there are lots of opportunities to get educated. In Bozeman, Montana, we have the Montana Racial Equity Project, and Montana Rep does workshops all the time. So if you feel like you're just starting at ground zero, that's a great place to go. There are, racial equity book clubs at the library. So there's all sorts of opportunities for education. I think that totally matters. But I think consciousness matters. I mean, I really have been thinking this week and having some conversations on campus with people, when people in this moment suddenly do become awakened and say, oh my gosh, what can I do? You do want to help them not just get demoralized, because that's easy, right? And so, okay, you've got that consciousness all of a sudden. You realize this is real. It's not going away. You've been able to maybe not see it for a long time, but now suddenly you see it and you can't unsee it. Great. That feels terrifying, but that's an important first step. The second step is saying, I need to now do something about that. I'm not comfortable just with having that consciousness. I need to channel that consciousness into something, and I've now decided I want to do that. Now, what do I do? Right? And so that point is where all those resources become really important. But I think what do I do is not remain passionate every hour of every day for the rest of your life about this. I mean, yes, hopefully there's a low burning flame that keeps you moving, but really it's like, okay, join a book club and continue reading for the next 3 years, even after you think you know everything. Commit to donating money every month or every year to these organizations that are doing the work every day. It's okay if you can't do the work every day, but there are lots of people who are doing it, and your money will help them, right? Support businesses that are Black or minority led. Don't support businesses that won't pledge to commit racism, to fight against racism in their stores, right? I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do. And to a point, you just think, I'm all for passion, and I love what passion does for people. But I also think there's a point where you take a deep breath, you step back and you say, these are the things I'm going to do, and now I'm going to do them. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to fret about it, and I'm going to just do the things that need to be done. That's mm-hmm. the action. And it's often not terribly gratifying. Mm-hmm. You know, writing a $200 check, you know, every year, if you're a little bit strapped, doesn't feel gratifying. It's not visible, it's not public, it's not joyful, but it's so important. Mm-hmm. And those are, I think, the things that show the commitment to action.
It was interesting when you talked about following the lead of folks like in the Black Lives Matter movement, not needing to reinvent the wheel. It's interesting to ponder, you know, what would have happened if the activists in Minneapolis who successfully called for a total re-envisioning of the police department there, you know, we'll have to wait and see how real the follow-through is on that. I'm definitely going to hold judgment, but it seems to have provoked some pretty radical change. If they were taking guidance from Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer, that would not have even been a demand. It would have been, we need to have better training for police officers. Right. We need to do a better job at removing the ones who have these repeat violations of abuse. So, I mean, there are certainly some lessons, I think, to be learned there about the value of radicalism. Mm-hmm. And often the realistic path to change is through radicalism, not through pragmatism, as right. practiced by at least the Democratic Party leadership. Any thoughts about how that plays out?
Yeah, well, in that particular instance, I think it's interesting because I don't even really think there's a debate. I mean, if you want to be pragmatic, look at the data. And the data just shows those changes don't work. Right? I mean, like, they might be palatable to a lot of people, but if what you really want is change, moderate police department reforms don't work. People have been trying them for a long right. time. So, I mean, I don't think it's sort of an open field of, you know, who knows, maybe this will work, this moderate path, maybe the radical path will work. Like, the moderate path doesn't work. And so I think that's, you know, I understand where they're coming from. I mean, these people need to run for re-election, and they need a lot of white people who don't care about this to vote for them. But that can't be the that can't be the guiding light at the end of the day. And, you know, obviously when we have these discussions, I always go back to, like, what would really make a difference here? And it's just campaign finance reform, right? If elected officials could do what they thought was right and really be accountable to their constituents, not to donors, then we'd be in a different landscape.
I just want to remind folks, you are listening to The View from Here on KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman and online at kgvm.org. We're here with our guest, Dr. Sarah Rushing, and we were last talking about radicalism versus realism for change.
I'm not really on that track. I had something else pop into mind as you were talking, and something that strikes me that might have an educational component, so I'm talking to you as an educator, I guess, a little bit now, is a generalized feeling I get in our culture of dissociation from other people's experiences. That's why I asked you just a bit ago, mm-hmm. how do I make someone else's predicament mine? Right. What about compassion? You talked about passion and having a passionate stake in things, and you sort of applaud that, but realize that it's a longer game than that. My question is more about compassion. The disregard for truth versus lie is one manifestation, I think, of a certain coldness that that doesn't matter what the data says. It doesn't matter if it's true or false. What I say is what matters. And that comes from the highest levels of our government, but it's also filtered out into society. And I think there's a certain callousness that I feel in my day-to-day life, just in observing things in the news, maybe not so much in Bozeman, but in general, I feel that there's a kind of a coldness that also needs to be overcome. And have you thought about that much?
Yeah, I mean, I do think about that because I, you know, for whatever reason, in thinking about moving people politically in the last decade, I've adopted this language of tech adoption. So I think of the early adopters, the middle adopters, the late adopters, and the never adopters. So there are a lot of people who are never going to be part of this movement. I mean, there are a lot of people in the United States who are very invested in anti-Black racism, anti-Native American racism, and they're not interested in changing. So the idea that we all want a better America, I don't think is true. But I think there are a lot of people who are just potentially part of that movement, and they either know nothing, they don't think of themselves as political in any way, perspective on keeping peace is not getting into it, a discussion about complicated issues. They don't see themselves as in any way connected to it. So those are kind of the late adopters, and I think they come along when most of everyone else is already going down that road. So I think it's really kind of the like medium adopters that any of us need to engage with, mm-hmm. right? And those are the people who have started to have that consciousness mm-hmm. And are starting to think they might want to take action. Mm-hmm. And I think when I talk to people like that, I mean, you know, I'm a political scientist, but I had this moment, you know, probably, you know, a decade ago or when, you know, after I had just started teaching where I thought, I'm a political theorist who writes on democratic change and citizen subjectivity and really doesn't address race. And now I'm not a critical race theorist, and I have not become a critical race theorist, but I'm very aware of the fact that I can't do my scholarship and bracket race. I mean, that doesn't make any sense in the United States. And I think I had a moment where that occurred to me, and I thought, God, I'm A, totally embarrassed, and B, such an idiot. Like, that just is not a viable position to take. Like, I study this without thinking about race. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was really my own kind of part of my eye-opening. And then also just thinking, like, I didn't create the problem of racism. You know, I'm sure generations past of my ancestors in the South certainly did. But I've inherited it. And that is something I have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I can deal with it by ignoring it. That's one way of dealing with it. Mm-hmm. Or I can deal with it by not ignoring it. So for me, I just, you know, hit a point where I was like, I can't stomach mm-hmm. this. Having said that, when I engage with people about the question of race, you know, I sort of sometimes share my own process of developing some of that consciousness, but I'm very aware that sort of white people emotionally wrestling with their own pain over racism is not productive. And too often in racial justice movements, once white people get on board, that's what mm-hmm. they get on board for, is to wrestle with their own pain right. about having realized how bad racism is. And I'm like, okay, you yes. know, that doesn't help.
Yeah, but you're talking about someone who's already a ways further evolved personally, emotionally, and compassionately than what I'm talking about. When I think about, as a child, when I was learning civics and I saw the white policeman opening the fire hoses on the black protesters in the South, in Alabama and other states, and letting the dogs on the protesters and beating people with their batons, there was so much moral authority on the part of those protesters. What was happening to them was the most ghastly thing I'd ever seen. And my sense is, and I could be wrong on this, so I'm doing a reality check at the same time, that there's so much numbness on the part of American citizens right now that the moral authority of watching a policeman shove a 75-year-old man down, it's there, but it's still a plaything. It's still in play for all the reasons that we're talking about. President Trump just tweeted the other day, this morning or yesterday, that the whole thing could have been a setup. He might have been Antifa. And so the way that our emotions are constantly being toyed with through mechanisms of the media and misinformation, I think only makes that numbness that I'm sensing more exacerbated, right? Mm-hmm. And an obstacle to engaging in that sensitivity that you were just describing.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, in general, people should be fired up and they should be compassionate and they should see human suffering and feel it deeply and want to act out against it. And I also think we live in an incredibly complicated political moment. I mean, we have all these overlapping things right now. We have the, you know, opening up of a new election season where a very challenging president has the possibility of winning again. We have this pandemic, this COVID pandemic that has put us all on lockdown for months on end. And then we have this eruption of police brutality and public attention to it, and all of this constantly on social media. So while I think in a way numbness can be a cop-out, I also totally understand it. I mean, I feel numb a lot of the time. Right? So I think, at least in my thinking about that for myself, I thought, okay, then these actions need to not attach to my emotional excitement over doing them. Right? Numbness is sort of a fact of life in politics, I think. And so a lot of the things we do might just become rational responses to a problem we see in the world that we've committed to address. Mm-hmm. So it's great to show up for a march and sing and feel excited. And I love that. Mm-hmm. But it's also, again, the mundane, everyday commitment you make that you can do even if you feel numb.
One of the things that's been on my mind, I wonder if you have any thoughts on, Sarah, is obviously the graphic videotape of the murder of George Floyd was a really powerful catalyst because it was so undeniable. It was so horrific. Is there a way, without that kind of vivid documentation, that we can get people starting to broaden their focus from just what's gone on through police brutality against black people to paying attention to what's going on in ICE prisons, where thousands of Latino refugees and would-be immigrants are having their lives torn apart? They're horrific abuses going on there too. The abuses that take place on a per capita, at least as great a basis, if not greater, of abuse of Native Americans when they have encounters with police. We're certainly not going to get much of that video documentation from within ICE camps, where it's a lockdown facility, and it's probably a lot less likely when it comes to scenarios with Native Americans. So is there a way to use this as kind of an opening to broaden people's awareness to address different people who are suffering just as badly from oppression in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think your point is such a good one. You know, there's been a lot of talk this week about, you know, what would have happened in the absence of this video, because there's police brutality all the time that doesn't get recorded, even with body cameras, and certainly without them, and it's happening, right? And then there are these other contexts inside prisons, inside detention camps, and other places where there will never be video. So if video is what it takes, then again, you know, we can't wait for that moment. I mean, I think it's a galvanizing moment. And in this case, it was so clear. I mean, to me, I think that's, I mean, George Floyd's death is so tremendously horrible. And the fact that it took watching someone die on camera over 9 minutes for a lot of people to say they couldn't take it anymore. I mean, you know, the cynic in me is like, that's horrible. And the optimist in me is like, okay, whatever it takes. I mean, it's horrible, you know? And we can't rely on visual images always being present. So again, that's why I think we have to sort of tack this course between being impassioned and reawakened and just being practical and committed and listening to people in the community who suffer from these grievances when they tell us, and believing that they're real. And just because we didn't see them doesn't make it not real. And just because, you know, I know so many really well-meaning white people who, when you tell them about racist things that happen to other people, it doesn't make sense to them. They're like, well, there just had to be something else going on there. And you're like, there's just not. You know, there's just racism. That's how it works. As a white person, we'll never feel that the same way. So if you're waiting for that, you're going to wait a long time. Mm-hmm. So I think you got to come at it a different way.
That's kind of a classic racist statement, isn't it? That those people must have been doing something first, right? Because all they understand is this kind of a brutal response. They don't understand anything less than violence, right?
Well, and it's not even that. It's just like, well, there just must be other factors that aren't being recalled in this story that would make this kind of behavior on the part of a white police officer make sense. Right? I think if you grow up with white privilege and with class privilege and with gender privilege, I mean, women have a very different story about living in the public world than men. You don't see these things. You don't experience them. They're not part of your consciousness. And so it just doesn't make sense. And so we can do a lot of work to educate ourselves and understand, like, these things totally make sense. But also, if we're waiting to feel it the same way you would feel it, then you're not gonna take the action. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. There's like a burden of proof that is too high. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be waiting for that.
Yeah, and even when the burden of proof is met on, you know, visually on recordings of Philando Castile's murder by a Minneapolis policeman 3 years ago, it was undeniable what happened there. He was simply killed by a panicked cop for absolutely no reason. Right. But yet without, it didn't have that element of the brutality and the willfulness that this one did. So even with all the evidence that there was no justification, there was no reason, there was still almost no reaction from outside the black community in that case. Right. I mean, certainly there were activists who got out and protested, but that, you know, you ask people across the country, who's Philando Castile, and you probably get a blank look from most of them today.
Right.
We've talked about the sort of difficulty in finding the energy to join up with the movement, and we started talking about how movements are coherent and sometimes are episodic. And what I want to talk about is the other side, that is the side of our established government systems, our institutions. And it's probably too early to ask this question, but I'll just throw it out there anyway. Have you noticed any kind of pushback that you think will develop into a larger response from the current administration from its point of view, right, which is quite different from what we've been talking about here, a sympathetic point of view to the Black Lives Matter movement. Have you noticed anything shaping up on the part of the government? Like, this is what the government's going to do in response.
Oh, like in terms of the Trump administration?
Yeah. Like,
you mean other than military streets?
Like
weaponry?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But that's the question. Do you think that's the shape of things to come? Is a greater militancy and a greater scandalizing of protest participants as scumbags and as ne'er-do-wells or whatever the language might be.
Thugs.
I mean, I don't know why that wouldn't happen. I don't know what would have to take place for that not to happen, because that's been the trend for 4 years now, and much longer. I mean, you know, people in government are not particularly sympathetic to protesters, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, really, right? And the media, for, you know, as long as I can remember, depicts protesters as kind of crazy and rabid. So I don't think our mainstream institutions, protesting makes good news, but often covered in a very selective way. So maybe that's what's changing, is mainstream media outlets are being much more kind of intentional about how they frame these events in a way that indicates sympathy with protesters. In the past 2 weeks, there's been a really big discussion about never using the word looting when you're covering violence in response to brutality on the part of poor and communities of color, right? I mean, looting is just not a useful way to describe that. And I think a lot of mainstream media outlets are starting to recognize there are other ways of describing those acts that isn't so loaded and kind of carries a history of that bias, right? So I have a little more confidence in the media than I do in mainstream political officials, particularly right now. But I mean, I don't know. Is your question like, do I have hope that the Trump administration is going to change its tactics in the next couple months? I mean, I think if anything, they will crack down more because chaos and crisis is good for re-election.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's clear that there's Donald Trump and much of the many of the people in his administration have strong fascist tendencies. I think that much is clear to any clear-thinking person. The question is there enough being done to counter that? What do you think of what you've seen so far, Sarah? And do you have ideas on how do we proactively prevent that from taking any further hold?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not sure in the time that is left before the November election, there's a lot to be done other than continuing to call it out. I think this is a really interesting moment because, you know, we're such a polarized country, and that polarization really emerged again and again, but recently in the COVID-19, the response to the pandemic, right? With this sort of, it's my freedom to be out and about in the world the way I want to be versus like in, you know, hopes of social solidarity, let's stay home and keep people healthy. And then how that turned on a dime in terms of like, everyone should stay home and get out of the way of the police versus we need to be out in the street, right? I mean, like these contradictions to me are I'm rarely speechless. And there are many political theorists who have not been rendered speechless by this, and they're saying some really important things about it. But I look at these contradictions and I just think, how is that possible? You know, I find that, I think, maybe the most disturbing thing for thinking about what's going to happen down the road, is that there are these deep contradictions, right? You have people on the right who are anti-vaccines, right? And that has come out very strongly in this COVID-19 moment. And one of the rallying cries they've recently mobilized is "My Body, My Choice." And I hear this and I think, surely you know the history of that saying. And yet you're told many anti-vaccine people are very anti-abortion. So I'm like, I don't even know what to do with that contradiction. So I think those are the things that make me think we both have to be vigilant, and I don't even know exactly how to be vigilant in that world.
Mm-hmm. To me, that feature of the of maintaining contradictions without being flustered by it, without noticing it, to me that's a part of the numbness, right? And it's when people are unable to cogitate anymore that they will follow the leader. And we know what our leader is like, this sort of authoritarian, whatever comes out of Donald Trump's mouth to many millions of Americans is true. So that can change from 6 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning, and it probably will 4 times in 45 different tweets, right? And to me, that's what's frightening. And so I was asking you, I guess, if you had been looking and finding things where you see Trump starting to make more concerted moves, and it's probably too early to notice that. I mean, we do know that he likes chaos. We do know that I thought he was baiting people to get it back out into the streets, and he was happy to bring in the military to see if that would stir up more violence. I find him to be a very callous human being with a tremendous amount of cruelty as a person. And so I find that to be so disorienting, because people look to the leader and they follow the leader.
Right. And, you know, as a teacher, you know, I have students who are very conservative, not Trump supporters. I have students who are libertarian Trump supporters, conservative Trump supporters, and then, you know, students on the left who were diehard Bernie supporters. You know, I have students across the spectrum. I even have students who are political science majors who are kind of undecided, right? They're still kind of an open book politically. And I find that fascinating. And also, like, I love my students. I respect my students so much. When I hear people say, oh, the left is just trying to indoctrinate people in the university, I'm like, you should come to my classes and meet my students, because that's a really rude thing to say about them. Like, they're not indoctrinable. These are smart, critical thinking people. And some of them like Trump. So I really have to think in the classroom about, like, how do I both respect them as people and respect where they are politically and engage them as, you know, not my equals. I don't expect them to be able to engage with me, you know, the way I would engage with a peer, but I know they're smart and I know they have thoughts and I know they can articulate them. And so I really try to think, like, what's your thought process? You know, what leads you to continue to stand behind this person when you're studying political science and so much of what is being said, you know, isn't true? And I don't understand that. I find it confusing, but I don't think they're dumb, obviously, and I don't think they're duped, and I'm not really sure what explains it. But as a teacher, I actually have to be much more sort of, and I want to be much more curious, you know, than kind of dogmatic, which I can, you know, as a person having a beer with a friend talking about politics, I can get really dogmatic. But in the classroom, that's not my mode. And so I try to understand. And I think there is just a tremendous amount of anxiety, a tremendous sense that the world is changing at a pace that nobody can quite get a handle on. And people who have traditionally been in groups that had dominance are going to lose that dominance. I had a student in a class a couple semesters ago studying diversity and why diversity matters. And he was a really wonderful guy, white guy from a ranch in Wyoming. And partway through the semester, he said, God, learning about all this stuff makes me feel so bad. And I went into this whole, oh, no, guilt is never productive. We're not here to feel guilty. We're here to learn. He goes, no, I don't feel guilty. I'm going to have to work so much harder to succeed now because there's so much more competition. And I was like, yeah, that's true. And also, like, I understand that's a blow to him. You know, like, I don't think that should determine anything going forward. But as a human being, I see that he's having this moment where he's thinking, damn, mediocre white guys do not have a lock on the future anymore. You know, and that is painful. I mean, so deal with it and let's move forward together. But, you know, as an educator, I'm much more sort of inclined to really have some curiosity about what explains this.
Go ahead. That got me thinking, do you have thoughts through your experience teaching at MSU about how do your observations in the classroom direct your thinking about what we need to do to have a more engaged public to strengthen democratic institutions? Do you get any insights from the conversations you have with your students, Sarah?
I mean, you know, with my students, I'm always in a pedagogical mode, and I'm really deeply committed to the fact that engaging with people pedagogically is productive. And what I mean, and that doesn't have to be, you know, limited to the classroom, but I think it's so easy to be angry and to be kind of tired of trying to persuade people. And as white people, especially with racial justice, we should not indulge that, right? Black people fighting for racial justice are exhausted and they should take a break. But as white people, like, I think we, you know, it'd be easy for me to say, ugh, I'm done. I've been trying hard enough here. No, I don't have that, you know. Right, but I also can really be pedagogical about it. Say, when I see these things, here's how I understand them when I look back historically, or when I see these things, I feel really worried about this. And with my students, I think that's often what opens conversation, right? Is my saying, this makes me worried, or I personally am really uncomfortable with this, right? Like, yes, I want our classroom to be a place where you can say whatever you want. And I stand behind that. But some things, when they're said, make me really uncomfortable, and I feel like I need to speak out of it. And there's a more pedagogical mode. It's not lashing people, it's not shaming people, but it is trying to sort of keep that conversation going. And I think that if we thought about engaging with people, for example, in our Facebook conversations in a way that was more pedagogical than combative, we might actually make a difference. I think that takes a lot of energy. It's really hard, but I think often we just underestimate how little people know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and I think your conversation with the Wyoming ranch kid is interesting, because my sense of it, I wasn't there, I'm just ballparking, but my sense of his comment was that underlying the anxiety you said you noticed in him was this notion that somebody has to lose. Yeah. In any environment where there's a group of people, they're going to get separated out into winners and losers. Now the chances have increased that I might get on the wrong side.
Right.
But the very notion that we start with, that there are winners and losers, that somehow is ingrained in us from a young age, as opposed to thinking that winning and losing, maybe that should be bracketed, right? Let's just talk about all of us thriving, right? And how we do that as a group. In such a fashion that people don't get left behind, or at least not to the extent that they are today. And I feel like sometimes white people do have a kind of a guilt reflex, although he disavowed any sense of guilt. There must be some residue in there there must be an awareness that he's not fully conscious of, that I have enjoyed privilege. And it's been, my comfort has been at the expense of someone else's discomfort, of someone else's pain. Right? And that's a hard thing to deal with. And it could be that sometimes we force those thoughts out of our mind and keep it rational. And so I keep going back to this sense of warming up the atmosphere. And I think also as an educator, that's what I try to do in my classroom. Although I do teach some political science courses, but they're like ancient theory, right? But even in a writing classroom, it doesn't matter what the classroom is. The environment that you create speaks volumes in itself. The way that you interact with your students and the way that you encourage them to interact with each other is a gigantic civics lesson in itself. And I don't know, I feel like what you're doing is good work, and trying to warm up the environment, to me, although it's not as important as being involved in systemic change to the system, I don't know how you can do it without warming up the environment, because there has to be kind of a realization at some point that we're in it together, right?
One of the things coming through my mind right now is there any historical moment that you can think of, Sarah, that has parallels that might be useful to scrutinize when we're looking at what's going on in the United States today?
You know, I think there's a real tendency, because of the kind of figure Trump is, to go to, you know, pre-World War II Germany and the Third Reich and Hitler. And you know, I mean, in political science, we always joke about, like, you know, you can't just go straight to Hitler.
Right.
You know? And my partner has a German mother and a Jewish father. And when I first started dating him and we would go to dinner with his parents, I'd say, it's like literally 10 minutes till your parents are at Hitler every meal. And it's still the case. And they're incredible, wonderful discussions. And, you know, his mom was a German refugee. She escaped from communism in East Germany, but, you know, certainly her family endured the Third Reich. And then his father's family came over much, much earlier from Czechoslovakia, Jewish, right? And so they're rich, fun discussion that always ends at Hitler. And in political science, we sort of say, like, you can't play the Hitler-Trump card. Now, the Hitler-Trump card means a lot today, and so it's really hard not to draw those parallels. There are a lot of books coming out in the past couple of years and forthcoming on fascism. I do think it's really important to understand that history. I also just think I am personally not totally clear how those lessons guide us today. I think it's very easy to dwell in a kind of ethos of political paranoia. I think social media has really ramped up this, while you were looking in the other direction, guess what happened over here? And that just stokes anxiety. And so I don't think that's a useful mode. I'm not sure comparing Trump to Hitler is going to get us anywhere.
No, but I mean, what he's doing right out in the open is concerning enough. And Yeah, I agree totally with it.
But I want to do it all the time, don't get me wrong.
and I'm not as knowledgeable as some of the authoritarian rulers in other countries today, but it seems like he draws a lot of his inspiration from folks like Vladimir Putin. It seems like he's almost guided by more of the present-day examples that maybe he's
I'm not sure how much he's guided by sort of retrospection or knowledge of any sort. I mean, I don't know. Right. I don't study Trump. I haven't and I won't. I think he's fascinating. I go back and forth between thinking he's incredibly complex or totally simplistic. But I do think he doesn't have a lot of tools in his toolbox. And domination is his main tool. And I think, you know, that is terrifying to me because it's very comforting to a lot of people. Authoritarianism makes a lot of people feel like there's control. And what they would like is control at the expense of complexity and change. And I get that. I have an authoritarian in me, too. I've learned more about it as a parent than I ever thought I would. And it's an impulse a lot of us find in us, in ourselves, and have to resist. But I think that is really Trump's main tool. And so I think we can learn from history about that, about being vigilant. But mostly, I think we need to really think in our own kind of organic American context about what American democracy is and can be. I mean, I don't think American democracy has ever been what it could be. I think it's always been a promise and a hope, but I think it's a worthy promise and a hope in many ways, and I think it's tremendously at risk right now. And there's a lot of great books. I mean, Democracy in Chains, I think a book came out a few years ago, really, I think, elucidates that risk very well. But I think being able to become fluent in the language and the value of democracy is probably one of the best tools to combat fascism globally. And democracy isn't, it's not a silver bullet. I mean, it's a procedure, but it's also a value system. And that value system is equality and representation. And I think those things are important, and I think we don't have nearly enough of them right now, and we're going in the wrong direction.
When you were talking about the Hitler card, I was thinking of my own classroom when I'm teaching writing. Of course, sometimes we'll take on the weighty subject of human nature, and students like to debate whether it's basically good or basically evil, and it doesn't take more than 20 minutes into the very first discussion that Hitler comes up, right, as the extreme example of utter evil. And I also don't let them use Hitler anymore. You can't do that. One of the things I think it does is it gives them a comfort that they can compartmentalize within themselves out Hitler, right? No Hitler in me. Hitler was that guy, that historical figure who did all those atrocious things to humanity. And because we can encapsulate the worst in us outside ourselves in this other figure who thankfully no longer exists, we can sort of wish away our own complicity in things. And I feel like so much of education is self-awareness, teaching students to actually face what's inside, like what you did with that Wyoming ranch kid, to me is that's the height of education, is when someone looks inside oneself. And it's not always a pleasant experience. And it doesn't have to be pleasant. And in fact, if it is pleasant, my hunch is you're missing something important. But I do believe that's where the softness comes from, and that's where the compassion that I so wish could take hold is in that real accounting of oneself. I mean, I also read Taoism with my students, and one of the passages of the Tao is stop trying to control events. The world is uncontrollable. It's always out of your grasp. And if people could just sit on a cushion for an hour a day and stop bothering other people, we might have a better world. That's a sort of a quietism which has nothing to do with movements, right? It has nothing to do with protest. It has nothing to do with passion. But I think it would be a better world.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking when I was getting ready to do this interview about action, right? And what is action? And Hannah Arendt wrote this great book. Hannah Arendt was a Jewish refugee from Germany who came to the U.S. and then covered the Eichmann trials in Jerusalem for the New Yorker in the 60s, and then wrote a number of just massive books looking at totalitarianism and human nature. She wrote a book called The Human Condition, which has these various dimensions in her account. And the kind of most distinctly human dimension is action. And she says the nature of action is that it doesn't control what it does. And nonetheless, we have to do it. And so acting in concert publicly with others is what makes the possibility of creating a new world. You have to do it. But you don't know what it's going to create. You don't control the trajectory. And you don't control the story. If the action has positive consequences down the road, you will be heralded as a hero. And if it doesn't, who knows? And that can't be the motivation. but you have to join together with others and act in public, because that's the only way new worlds are cracked open.
That sounds like a great, great way to end the show. Thanks so much for joining us today, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening to another episode of The View From Here with Jeff Milchen and Steve Kirchhoff. Today we were joined by Dr. Sarah Rushing, political science professor at Montana State University. Thank you so much for coming in, Sarah.